So what has happened in the last 6 months that makes you so much more concerned about the next 6 months?
I think we are in some sense, we are experiencing a new world in terms of macroeconomic and finance. So the world is facing stubbornly high inflation. This is a challenge that he has not seen for decades, with huge uncertainty about the global economy, geopolitical landscape, and disruption in energy and commodity markets arising from the COVID pandemic, as well as the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And it'll take time to adjust to the new world. My name is Fabio Nadolucci. I'm a deputy director in the Monetary and Capital Markets Department of the IMF. I'm responsible for the Global Financial Stability Report, one of the flagship of the fund that focuses on global financial stability issues. Also oversee the IMF Global Financial Markets Monitoring, including sustainable finance markets, so the use of finance, private capital, to address climate change.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In normal times, the Global Financial Stability Report, or GFSR, tries to help prevent crises by spotting dangerous trends in the financial system and help policymakers counter those risks. But these are not normal times. In this episode, we look at the new risks to the financial system in a financial landscape that is, in many ways, new territory.
After the global financial crisis 15 years ago, inflationary pressure were very muted. So central bank kept interest rates very low for years, and investors became accustomed to a low rate, low volatility environment. Financial conditions very easy that supported growth, but also contributed to risk-taking and a build-up of financial vulnerabilities. Now we are in a different world. We have inflation at multi-decades high. We have central banks in advanced economies accelerating the pace of policy normalization to ideally prevent inflationary pressure from becoming entrenched, and importantly, inflation expectation from de-anchoring. Policymakers in emerging markets, they start hiking earlier in 2021. They have continued to tighten. They've seen rising inflation, currency depressions, although there are a number of regional differences. And global financial conditions have tightened. Part of it is an intended objective of policy to contain inflationary pressure. Part reflect a risk of sentiment in markets. So some of the risks that we have highlighted have crystallized related to slowdown of the global economy, slowdown particularly in China, inflationary pressure. And there's a risk that a disorderly tightening of global financial condition may interact and amplify by vulnerabilities that have been building over the years. So the focus of this chapter essentially is to discuss some of the conjunctural and structural vulnerabilities in advanced economies and emerging markets in the new current macro-financial environment. This is a new environment that is new to policymakers and market participants. And we have seen some warning shots in markets. I'm thinking about distress and stress in UK markets. And this is a new asset allocation world. Rates are higher, vol is higher, and it'll take time for investors to adjust. And this will be a long process to adjust to the new world.
Indeed. And as we see the central banks globally now raising rates, some analysts are calling this the great tightening. But we've also heard concerns from some prominent economists out there that this is not necessarily a good thing, that this uncoordinated effort by central banks everywhere to rein in inflation could in fact make things worse for the global economy. What's the concern there?
I think this is an important point here. Price stability is a crucial prerequisite for sustained inclusive economic growth. There is no growth, sustained growth, without price stability. So this is an important objective that policymakers have. So to address this inflationary pressure, and again, preventing the dynamics would be entrenched, inflation expectation would start being de-anchoring, feed into wage spiral that would be making it more difficult to control inflation. We have seen emerging markets starting to tighten monetary policy in 2021. With some regional differences, maybe I can come back later to the differentiation. Mm-hmm. Advanced economies have started hiking late last year, but they have accelerated. Think about the Fed, started with 25 basis point increase, then 50, and then 375 hikes. Yeah. ECB, 50, 75, and they're starting also to shrink their balance sheet, what's called quantitative tightening. Now, there are global aspects to inflation, right? So if you can think of supply chain disruption, those are global, clearly global factors. There are disruption in commodities market that related to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, And we have seen the significant impact that had in terms of energy shock in Europe, for example. There are also domestic factors that could be related to fiscal policy. So the pandemic stimulus, right? The US is a good example. So there are important country differences. That's one point I think I want to make. Now, tightening of financial condition is the intended objective of policy. So this is how you slow down aggregate demand. Right? So there is some part of the component of the inflationary pressure that perhaps monetary policy cannot address, but monetary policy can certainly address the demand side of this by tightening financial condition. Now, central banks have domestic mandates, price stability, but also, this is important, they incorporate external sector spillover effect when they are forecast model. So indirectly, they take into effect the impact that inflation on domestic inflation that is coming from the rest of the world. I think if all central banks act resolutely to try to bring inflation down back to target, then hopefully there will be less hiking that is needed globally.
Mm-hmm. So you spoke mostly about the advanced economies of the world there. What do all these rate increases mean for emerging markets and the low-income countries?
So, as I said, emerging markets have started to hike in 2021. There were important regional differences in terms of inflationary pressure. For example, they were more evident, say, in Latin America or Central Eastern Europe than Asia, but also in terms of the extent and pace of tightening. Again, Latin American countries start hiking earlier and at faster pace than, say, Central Eastern European countries or Asian emerging markets. Now, rising rates in advanced economies and including the global risk-off sentiment, particularly in the last few weeks, clearly have put pressure on foreign exchange and sovereign spreads. Although there are, again, important differentiation, not just regionally, but whether you are, for example, a commodity exporter or a commodity importer in terms of trade shock, but also in terms of sovereign spread. So we have seen clearly that emerging market spreads, sovereign spreads have widened. The widening has been way more pronounced for frontier and high yield, so sub-investment grade countries, than for investment grade. If you look at the investment grade spreads, those have moved more or less sideways within a tight range since the beginning of the year. Now, to address, to limit currency volatility and the impact on inflation, some countries, Chile, Czech Republic, Indonesia, Philippines, Malaysia, they have resorted to FX intervention. We also seen very large portfolio outflows in local currency debt. For example, China, we have seen $75 billion outflows, while equity outflows have been more modest. Now, if you look at investment funds, not a balance of payment data, but investment funds outflows, we have seen about $60 billion so far this year. That's roughly 10% of asset under management. Now, emerging markets face a multitude of risks, right? They stem from pressure from advancing economies tightening, high external borrowing costs. We've seen very volatile commodity prices, uncertainty about the global economy, and also risk of disorderly restructuring of global supply chains. That's been an important driver of growth for these countries. And they have some significant vulnerabilities, just to pick a few. They have very high public debt. So public debt to GDP went from 36% in 2021 to almost 60% in 2022. They have high budget deficit toward these high historical ranges, elevated inflation. Some countries also have very wide current account deficit. Now, that said, there are also some mitigants. For example, FX reserves are generally healthy in most emerging markets, although there is a tail, what we call vulnerable tail, the 25th percentile. They are below the recommended level of reserve adequacy. Also, as another mitigant, they depend less on foreign investor and inflows. Since COVID, and that could actually be soften the impact if there is an episode of risk off. Now, frontiers face even greater challenges, right? The tightening of financial condition, deteriorating China fundamentals, the high exposure to commodity price volatility. Just to give you a few numbers, the median debt to GDP has doubled since 2010. Interest expense to government debt have risen, and food prices. Food prices is a huge challenge for these countries. Issuance has dried up in these countries, down 75%. So there's a risk that without a substantial improvement in market condition, they will have to seek other alternative to financing, such as bilateral or multilateral financing, including the IMF, or have to debt reprofile or restructure.
So what about crypto markets? I mean, the report looks very closely at the volatility in the markets that we're seeing. But what about crypto? Is this also a stability risk?
So we have seen crypto markets being extremely volatile, right? And this has been coming hand in hand with rising correlation with equity markets and poor market liquidity. For example, Bitcoin has lost 50% of its value We have seen some crypto funds that have been unwound. Terra, the largest non-collateralized algo stablecoin, faced investor run, in fact, collapsed. Even Tether, which is the largest collateralized stablecoin, for a while traded below parity, saw significant outflows. That was in contrast to other cash-backed, more transparent stablecoin that actually saw inflows. So overall, we are paying a close attention to this. It's part of our assessment of risk-taking and vulnerability, and we will keep monitoring and think what the appropriate policy response should be.
So the question now is, will all this lead to a recession? And how much is simply the risk of a recession impacting the big important actors in the economy, like the global corporate and housing sectors?
So the fund, just to be clear, the IMF is not calling a recession. But of course, we don't look just at the baseline. The WEO has a downside risk scenario, for example, that is pretty notable in terms of impact on growth. And also we use what we call the growth at risk methodology in the Global Financial Stability Report. Essentially, we look at the entire distribution of future world GDP growth. Now, if you look at the entire distribution, particularly what we call the left tail, the balance of risk there are really skewed, squarely skewed to the downside. And that downside risk compared to historical norms are very high. Just to give you a number, the probability of growth falling below zero is about 10%.
Wow.
So clearly there are notable significant downside risks to growth. The global tightening of financial condition, it's clearly putting pressure on the global economy and unmasking, if you want, and interacting with a number of vulnerabilities. So you pick two sectors here. One is the corporate sector. Mm-hmm. The corporate sector is facing higher labor costs, higher input costs, and those are weighing on profitability. And in fact, earning forecasts have been revised, starting to be revised downward. We have seen spreads widening meaningfully, including in investment grade, not just the sub-investment grade, but also for the more creditworthy borrowers. We have seen issuance in the sub-investment grade sector, what we call leverage finance, so high-yield corporate bonds, leverage loans, that in Q3 set a new post-GFC law. We have seen SME bankruptcy starting to increase in advanced economies, so that for smaller firms, they're facing higher borrowing costs, declining fiscal support from COVID, and also higher costs, both labor and inputs. I think the focus here is that there could be spillover effect to the lenders, right? So if the credit cycle is turning and we start seeing a wave of default, that could have implication for banks. Obviously, banks play a crucial role for SMEs, but also for non-bank financial institutions, so non-bank lender. Think about, investment funds, insurance companies, pension funds, other non-bank lenders that actually provide credit to the real economy. The other sector is housing. Housing is showing signs of overheating, and there's a risk of a sharp fall in house prices. Mortgage rates are rising, affordability is declining, and lending standards by mortgage lenders are tightening. Our internal analysis shows that in a what we call severely adverse scenario, real house prices, and again, this is not nominal, this is real house prices, could decline over the next year by almost 25% in emerging markets and more than 10% in advanced economies. And then finally, obviously, pressure in the housing sector has been an important driver of the slowdown in China. And so we're looking carefully to that and the possible spillover effect from the property developer sector to the broader housing market, to the banks and to the local governments, and how this spillover effect could fit into each other.
And so the other thing that you speak about in the Global Financial Stability Report is climate change, of course. And all this comes at a time when emerging markets and developing economies need to be scaling up their climate mitigation efforts if they're to fulfill their commitments under the UN's Sustainable Development Goals. How do these environmental issues fit into your latest GFSR?
So we had a chapter two of the report that focused on challenges and opportunities in scale-up private climate finance in emerging markets and developing economies. Essentially, the issue is that at this point, about two-thirds of greenhouse gas emissions come from emerging markets. So addressing that challenge is crucial, not just for those countries, but also for advanced economies themselves. The problem is that fiscal support is probably going to be limited, right? These countries are coming out of COVID with very high debt levels, fiscal deficit. So it's unlikely that they'll be able to provide a lot of public money. So private finance needs to play a crucial role here. So the report looked into challenges, barriers, but also opportunities. I want to stress the word opportunities. Challenges, there are a number of them. They go from like the lack of like projects, for example, off the shelf project, risk related to specific project, difficulties in aggregating this project. So some of it is about the demand, if you want, for funding, but then also related to the supply. So how, for example, to have proper return. So project that can be scalable, bankable, and they provide the right return for investor. How to think about the structure that you can actually use to lever up, aggregate this project, and then provide access for different investors. So we look into possible solution. So again, in the spirit of opportunities. And I think the policy recommendations include the following points. First of all, I think we need to set up, there is to be the proper investment climate. So that requires climate policies like carbon pricing, for example, as well as what we call the climate information architecture. So the importance of climate data, transition taxonomies, as well as disclosure. Then we also need to broaden the range of instruments. So we need to think creatively about financial instruments. We need to broaden the set of investors. We need to try to bring in as much private capital as possible. There are different types of capital out there, from philanthropic capital, impact capital, investment funds, banks. So we need to all of them and broaden this investor set. Multilateral development banks will play a crucial role here. We need to use as much as balance sheet as possible, obviously, but also use the balance sheet in a more efficient way. We need to lever up public money more. Again, we need to strengthen the climate information architecture. Then the IMF itself can play a role. The fund just launched the new RSD fund, and that fund can actually be helpful to attract and catalyze private capital. So combine debt prep lending, this is like long-term below market price lending, for the purpose of increasing resilience and sustainability, but including in the climate field. So that could have a catalytic impact in terms of attracting private capital, but also in terms of taking the lead for improving quality of data as well as improving disclosure.
All right. And so here's where you tell us how to fix all this. What does this report offer in terms of guidance for governments looking for a way out of this complicated scenario?
I think we can break the policy recommendation in three parts, right? What has to do with monetary policy, what has to do with fiscal policy briefly, and then the macroprudential policy tool. In terms of monetary policy, again, as I mentioned before, I think price stability is the crucial prerequisite for economic growth here. So with risk to inflation tilted to the upside, central banks should continue to normalize monetary policy to prevent inflationary pressure from being entrenched. They need to act resolutely and bring inflation back to target. The risk is that not doing so and letting the inflation expectation be anchored would damage credibility that has been built over the past several decades. So they should heed the lessons of the past. Moving too slowly to restrain inflation, restore price stability, may require more costly subsequent tightening. So more painful, disruptive economic adjustment later. And the historical experience of the U.S. monetary policy of the 70s and early 80s clearly offer clear lessons. Now, there is also a need to rethink about communication, right? So the communication that was provided when we are at the effective lower bound has been very important since the GFC, but we need to rethink that. We need clear communication about the policy function, so objective, intertemporal trade-off, step required to bring inflation down to target, and also reaffirm the commitment to achieve the objective mandates to preserve credibility. In terms of monetary support, obviously, there is also a risk that financial conditions, as I said before, may tighten sharply, right? And economic growth may slow more than anticipated in coming months. That could prompt calls for a pause in the policy normalization. I think authorities should be wary of such calls and consider deploying appropriate tools in case of market dysfunction. So what is critical here is to avoid a stop-go policy normalization path that could undermine price stability and result in a disorderly tightening of financial conditions. Now, monetary policy in terms of fiscal policy could get support from tighter fiscal policy in achieving the mandated inflation objective. So in addition to keeping to help limit government debt burden, fiscal consolidation can actually ease aggregate demand pressure on prices. So moderating the extent of policy normalization required to rein inflation. So essentially, fiscal policy should not work at cross-purpose with monetary policy. They should work in sync. And then finally, policymakers should continue to contain the buildup of financial vulnerability. Obviously, country-specific circumstances, near-term economic challenges matter, but they should adjust selected macroprudential policy tools as needed to tackle pockets of related vulnerabilities, while at the same time avoiding a disorderly tightening of financial condition. If these tools don't exist, for example, in the non-bank financial intermediation, they should urgently, policymakers should urgently develop them. It's important here to strike a balance between containing the buildup of vulnerabilities and avoiding procyclicality and a disorderly tightening of financial condition. That's the three main group of policy recommendations as they relate to monetary policy, fiscal policy, and macroprudential policy tools.
Well, Fabio Natalucci, Deputy Director in the Monetary and Capital Markets Department and Head of the Global Financial Stability Report. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Look for the latest Global Financial Stability Report, or GFSR, at imf.org/GFSR. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.